we spend all evening, my wife and I, arguing about A, what we're going to watch, and you've got to then flip between the different streaming services. What's on Amazon Prime? What's on Netflix? What's on Apple TV? What's on Disney? What's on? You spend the whole evening, and then you forget. Mm-hmm. Oh, what was that? Which one was that film back on? Was it on Prime? I can't remember. So you've got to go. It's become such a time-consuming thing. At least when we went down to the video stop, that was the film for the evening. No argument. Well, you argued in the video store, didn't you?
The power to tell a story is in us all. The power to change the way we feel, our understanding. Change the rules, how we see ourselves. Provoke. Change history. Together, let's change the bigger picture. Change access. Put camera gear in more hands and keep the story going. Buy, sell, and trade used camera gear. MPB.
Hello and welcome to the Home AV Podcast for Monday, the 16th of September, 2024. And it's podcast 750. So if you missed any of them, it's all archived. You can go back and listen to them all the way back at the start. The very first episode of the AV Forums podcast was presented by somebody called Jason Bradbury. Where is he these days? But anyway, welcome along to episode 750 of the Home AV podcast. If you've been listening to us this year, we are segmenting the subject of Home AV, building your own media room, your own home cinema, or your own living room. Do's and don'ts, tips, that kind of thing. We've been covering it all year in 2024. We intend to carry it through to the end of the year. And we are up to displays last month. And it took so long that we didn't quite get around to sources. So this week we're talking about sources. We're talking about Cedia. Who are they? What do they do? Who knows? Steve's going to tell us. And we're also going to talk about my own build, which is going to get started very soon. So those are the subjects. Who's on the podcast? Who are these faces that you can see looking back at you? Well, we got Dr. Julian Scott from Habitech. Hi, Jules.
Hi, Phil.
And we've also got Steve Carter from Cedia. Hi, Steve.
Hello, guys. How are you?
And what time zone are you in, Steve, at this moment?
My body is still in Denver. Definitely my mind is still in Denver. Case in point.
Is that a country and western song? Body's left in Denver?
It's about UFO abductions, isn't it?
There you go. So it'll all become apparent why Steve was in Denver last week. We're going to get to all of that. If you want to watch this podcast rather than just listening to it, it is on YouTube. You'll find it on the AV Forums podcast channel. Go over there, subscribe to the channel. You'll never miss a podcast, although that may be changing. But do it for the time being, and we'll tell you if it does change. If you enjoy the content and the podcast, and of course you like what we do here at AV Forums, then why not spread the word? Why not share this podcast on your socials or to your friends on forums and that kind of thing? It really is appreciated. And who are we? Well, we are the largest AV and hi-fi community in Europe, certainly, and one of the biggest on the internet. We've been around 20 odd years. We were started back in 2000, or founded back in 2000. Editorial started in 2003. And who am I? Well, I am Phil Hinton, and my legs hurt this week, and I'll tell you why in a minute. I've been around for 20 odd years as the editor of this site, and you will have seen my face in lots of videos and podcasts and everything else on AV Forums. I am certified and trained as a display calibrator with ISF, THX, and PVA. I do most of the TV reviews for the website, as well as lots of other things. I like audio as well, so I review audio now and again and so on. And also on the podcast, we've got Jules. Jules, tell us all about yourself.
I joined AV Forums as an enthusiast back in 2000. I think it was 3 or 4. I can't remember which exact year it was now. It was on the back of the Superb editorials. Then became a professional video calibrator with THX, and then professional PVA back in 2011, which is where I met Steve at JVC. I am now working for Habitech, which is obviously the UK's premier distributor, as their cinema specialist.
Excellent. And as we all alluded to, Steve Carter from Cedia. Steve, tell us all about yourself.
So, yeah, I've been in the industry just over 30 years. 20 years of that was spent with a manufacturer, a consumer electronics manufacturer. And then the last 10 years have been with Cedia, and I am their business development manager. So I travel the country speaking to our members, the trade supplier members, or manufacturers, or and also integrators. And the CEDIA, we are the trade association for the smart home industry. So essentially our members are either selling or integrating technology for consumers to experience within their homes.
Excellent. And it's a big, exciting area of the market. Technology moving on very quickly. We're going to cover all that, what CEDIA do and so on, a little bit later on. Before we get on with the show, you will forgive me for just doing a quick, very personal plug here, but I did run the Great North Run at the weekend at the time of recording this podcast, which is a half marathon. I did that for Diabetes UK. Did a little bit of training. My legs are really, really hurting right now. I never thought in my entire life I would run a half marathon. If you'd said to me just 12 months ago that would be the case, I would have laughed at you while I was chomping down on a pasty. But no, I've done the whole health kick and pushed myself, and I'd done a 5k up to that point. So it was quite the jump. But thanks to all the support I've had so far from everybody out there in the industry, friends and family, colleagues and so on, we've managed to raise £605 so far. I'd like to, if possible, get that up to about £1,000 if we can. So if you can in any way, any small amount, it would be appreciated. We've put a lot of effort into this. It's a great cause. So I just wanted to quickly mention that get that out there. And if you feel like supporting us, then please do. That really would be appreciated. Right. With all that said and done, and I can rest my legs because we're sitting down for the next hour, we're going to get on with the show. So the first thing we need to cover is video sources. So last time out, if you're listening to it in chronological order, we mentioned displays, the different types of displays that you can have in your room. Obviously, the room being one of the major factors. It sounds cliched, we mention it every time, but that is the case. The other important factor when it comes to displays is you can calibrate the display, but it all depends on your sources as well and other components that are connected within what we call the video chain. So that is the chain of components that use that display, whether they're all connected to each other or they're just connected to the display on different inputs and so on. Your sources are just as important as the display. And we need to make sure, Jules, that entire display chain is working accurately.
Absolutely. If your display is calibrated and accurate, but your source components are not set correctly, then you're not going to get a calibrated result, and it's not going to reflect what the colorist or the cinematographer, the director intended in post-production. So making sure that your Blu-ray player, your streaming device is outputting in the correct dynamic range with the correct color space, etc., going through those settings is very, very important.
And what are the common mistakes that you've seen people making in the video chain in terms of settings that can then affect, you know, how the image looks?
I think there can be a bit of confusion. Things like, you know, the chroma upsampling. For example, do I need 420, 422, or 444, or RGB, or, you know, people misunderstanding how that fits in, whether it makes a difference. Does it make a big difference? Does it not make a difference? Whether am I better doing that in the display or in the source device? You know, and in terms of upscaling as well, do you prefer if you're playing a Blu-ray, do you prefer your display to upscale that to 4K, or do you prefer your Blu-ray player, your 4K Blu-ray player to do that for you? Which one's better? There are decisions you can make throughout. Now, those can affect the end result, obviously. So making sure that everything is set optimally is obviously very important.
Yeah. And Steve, the source side of things, you know, this is the whole reason we put these systems in, is to sit down and enjoy watching something. So from that point of view, what changes have you seen in the 30 years that you've been in the business, and where do you think we are now in terms of sources and the choice available to people?
What I've seen is so all of us have come from an enthusiast background, so primarily looking at Blu-ray, and what I've seen is Blu-ray's now become a collection item. Uh-huh. Whether it be 4K box sets or limited editions or re-releases. But for the average consumer, that will be either Apple TV or going in-app on the display. I think with the ability to be able to just either use Apple TV, Sky Go, or whichever straight onto display, and then maybe even looking at a system like an Apple TV or an aggregated Skybox, which would have all those various applications on there. For the average consumer, I think that's where it goes primarily. And then for the real enthusiasts, if they can afford it, they'll probably go to something like a Keyscape, Kaleidoscape, if they want ultimate in video and audio quality.
Yeah. Go on.
I was going to say, Phil, I watched The Lost Boys the other night.
Great film. Great film.
It's so classically 80s, but it's got the scenes in the video store, you know, with renting the VHS and stuff. It takes me back.
And Blockbuster. Yeah.
God, how many years ago is it now? 40, 50 years ago? It's such a long time. But our children probably won't get the idea that we used to have to go out to a shop and rent physical media in order to bring it back. But it did make it an event, though, didn't it? You know, even though our TV...
It did. I mean, that was Friday night. You went down to wherever the I mean, it was an independent in my hometown called Spencey's, and it was the big thrill of the week. What can we rent? Or you go in on the Monday and you say, I want to reserve this for Friday night, and so on. And it was that thrill of seeing something that was in the cinemas a year ago, and you haven't. And I think that was a great thing as well. Up until then, it was, if you wanted to see a film again, you had to wait on it coming back around to your local cinema. Until video, you didn't have the opportunity to rewatch unless it was on TV, and things appearing on TV, it was sometimes 10 years after the original theatrical release before it appeared on TV. So, yeah, they don't know how good they got it these days in terms
of cinema to home.
What's the average time now from release to content?
Two months, something like 3 months, max.
If that. So usually about 6 weeks these days. Sometimes, you know, with Sky Originals and Netflix Originals and stuff, sometimes that's on the streaming side of things as it's at the cinema as well. So, yeah, things have, that model has changed a lot. But when it comes to the home, we're also, you know, spoiled for choice now when it comes to sources, but this can add issues, Jules. Like you say, the complexity, the making sure that, you know, you've got things like your HDMI throughput set correctly. You know, is it limited? Is it full? Do you set it to auto? You know, because that could really mess up your image quite severely if you have that set wrong and your black point's all wrong and suddenly everything looks milky and you're seeing things that you're not supposed to see and so on, opposed to how it should look. So what advice would you give to our audience? You've got to remember our audience is everybody from the super enthusiastic person who knows a lot about this to people who are just getting in and feel like it might be a silly question to ask, but what should I be looking at and what should I be setting correctly in my source?
Well, I think when it comes to Blu-ray players or UHD Blu-ray players, most of them actually come set pretty correctly out of the box nowadays, as far as those are concerned. You know, if you look, you know, not mentioning any particular brands, but I don't think there's any big howlers from any of the big manufacturers in terms of their setup. Some of them still do obviously come with picture controls within them. So you have the option, if you want to toggle to a vivid mode or a dynamic mode in them. So you just got to make sure that's not in one of those modes. It's one of the more accurate ones. And then you'll have to sort of look up. Did we the Picture Perfect, did that cover?
Yes, we did.
Those kind of things.
Sources. And again, that really hasn't changed over time. You know, I think Panasonic's menu system is the same as it was 10 years ago in terms of their players. Yeah. And, setting them up, it's still the same routine. And this is the thing, Steve, that I've certainly noticed as a reviewer. The last 4K Blu-ray player that we reviewed was probably a couple of years ago, because the manufacturing side of things is really slowed down. I think you've got Sony and Panasonic who are really still in the market. And then you have a couple of niche sort of Oppo style brands that are offering pretty high end machines, but that seems to be about it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I have seen another, so at Expo last week, there was another high-end streaming product. So out of the ashes from Zapiti, another company called Revolution. So where disc has sort of like moved away a little bit, there is still another opportunity with streaming now at a higher end as well. So for the real enthusiast that wants to back up their discs as well as being able to stream new content, there is another solution available nowadays.
Yeah. And Jules, it's going to get to the point where it comes to the laser assembly, the way that the discs are read. There's only a few manufacturers of that technology, and when they decide that the scale of the market is so drastically reduced to what it was, and it's costing more and more to make those, there has to be a time where that potentially could stop. We could lose CD players, Blu-ray players, and so on at some point down the line.
Well, it's a commercial market, isn't it, Phil? We've seen big companies in the past depart from the whole AV world, doing other things because they can make more money, So ultimately, it comes down to shareholders and making money. And if there's no volume there, if you can't make the money on the product, then they're going to not produce them. We've still got people in mourning after Oppo left, for to do their own thing there. It's sadly, as Steve says, it is a collector's market. But at some point, obviously, it's going to tip over the edge, and there won't be any more players. So what we want is, I mean, streaming's improving. New codecs, H.265, can certainly help. Better efficiency with lower bit rates is important. We want a bigger pipeline from the streaming companies to improve things. At the moment, if you want that true reference and you're not going for a UHD Blu-ray player, there is only really Kaleidoscape. They have brought out a cheaper model. I won't call it a cheap model. It's cheaper than it was before. It's still an expensive thing when you compare it to an Apple TV box. There are still those higher end options, and as I say, hopefully streaming can improve as well in the future. But at the moment, thankfully, UHD Blu-ray is still with us, and we have Kaleidoscape as another option as well.
Yeah, because I
must
I
admit, just to add to that, I don't know if you remember recently, but in the US, there was an announcement from a major retailer that said they were going to stop selling Blu-rays Blu-ray discs and also players, which was a real concern for the industry. And then all of a sudden, within the UK market, I'm getting bombarded, and about yourselves, because we're enthusiasts, you just get bombarded by a very key player now just launching from different distributors like Arrow or whomever, all re-releases on specific or box editions of specific titles.
Like you say, it's getting back to a collector's market. It's more of a niche, and that's a great thing if you're a film fan, because it means that the studios that are getting hold of these, the boutique labels, they are producing some really, really nice content that it's almost back to the days of Laserdisc. That's how I got into this hobby. It's what I was a very avid Laserdisc fan. I used to drop 50 quid a Laserdisc, a film, but back then it was the thrill that I was getting something that wasn't even at the cinemas in the UK yet. I could buy the US disc, and it was 6 months before it was at the UK cinema, and I could sit and watch it in my home cinema, and it had that appeal. But it also had the best picture quality at that point, up until DVD as well, and you had the collector's stuff like commentary tracks, like CAV discs, where you could do absolute frame by frame analysis of action scenes and so on. So that then moved to DVD, which was a phenomenal success and still is. It still
Still is.
outsells everything else by 5-to-1 ratio. People are still buying DVDs, which is great. But again, the convenience side of things is going to take over, as Steve's alluded to. Your streaming is getting better, as Jules has said. That convenience where you're sat on your sofa, you've switched the TV on, and it's like, well, I know I've got this film on disc somewhere. Am I going to go and find it, switch the Blu-ray player on, and put the disc in? Or here, it's on this streaming service. I just need to click the button and I can watch it straight away. You know what I mean? It's that convenience factor. So here's a bit of a very non-scientific straw poll amongst the three of us. Do you remember the last 4K Blu-ray you bought, and when was it, Jules?
Oh, Spears and Munsell.
So that must have been a while ago then.
Yeah, well, the latest three-disc edition.
So that would have been at least a year ago then, if not longer.
Yeah. In terms of films, I don't know, because I've got Kaleidoscape in my system. So, you know, for me, Kaleidoscape obviously is a big ticket thing, but I like the speed. You know, if I want to watch a film, I just buy it, and it's almost there, you know, within a few minutes. So it's getting to the point where Kaleidoscape is, as you know, is almost as fast as streaming, but with all the quality of a UHD Blu-ray. So I find that very convenient.
And that is the speciality with Kaleidoscape. That's what you're paying for. You're paying for it's basically almost the cinema file that you're getting at home. You know, it's a lot higher of quality. It's almost as good as the disc, if not better than the disc in some cases. But you're paying for that privilege.
I would say it's a poor man's Bel Air is kind of it's not really poor. It's an expensive piece of kit, but you know, there's still that thrill that you just alluded to there, Phil, about the fact that sometimes you can get stuff that's not quite out, or has just left the cinema here, or is still at the cinema, or even not even over here yet. So you can still find those kind of things, those little gems on Kaleidoscape as well, because they do premium rental services where you pay a bit more, but you can say to your friends, look, you know, this is on at the cinema right now, and you can come and see it at my place.
Yeah.
So there's still got that cachet about it.
Yeah. Steve, yourself, do you remember the last 4K Blu-ray you bought and when and what it was?
What day is it today? So on Saturday, I bought the Crow 4K remaster.
Excellent. Uh-huh. Good stuff. So you're still supporting the market. Well done.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And then the week before that was Aliens.
Excellent. Well, I don't know if it's that excellent or not. There's been a few comments about.
Oh, it's been quite divisive on opinions in terms of the. I am still. So the way I always look at it is, if I want to keep it, I'll buy it on UHD. If I just want to watch it and forget about it, then I'll watch it on streaming.
Yeah, and that's certainly the approach that I've had with that kind of thing. I think it's because I've been a collector for so long. And spent so much money on DVD. I mean, I had thousands of DVDs, and then it was a case of, well, what do I do with these now that they're worthless? And trying to shift them on, because you know you've got this huge collection which I'm not going to watch it anymore. And I've bought thousands of discs, and they're worth 50 pence a piece. And I paid 18 quid a disc. So I think, having been bitten by Laserdisc and bitten by DVD, I didn't do that much in terms of Blu-ray. I kind of got along the lines of, if I really want to own it, I'll have it on Blu-ray. And the same with 4K. Well, actually, I did HD DVD and got my fingers burnt on that one as well.
I've still got mine.
I've still got mine as well, yeah.
Two players and 100 discs.
Yeah, thanks to Shiba and Warners for that. And then obviously 4K Blu-ray. The last disc I bought, I think, was Top Gun Maverick.
Right.
That was the last one I went and actually purchased. There's a few others that I've wanted to buy, but then it's been the, am I actually going to watch this and so on? Because I bought quite a few of the 4K sets that I really want, like 2001 Space Odyssey, that kind of thing. Looks amazing. And some of the other box sets like that. True Romance, again, it's a film that I grew up with that film. I absolutely love that. And to have it on 4K Blu-ray, it's the best it's ever going to look. So, but yeah, I think the convenience thing is winning out. And again, I think the value for money thing as well, guys, is what people look at. So Kaleidoscape, if you've got a system that justifies it, Jules, which I know you have, and I think we need to explain to people that you were a dealer for a while, so you had a demo room where clients would come in and so you had to make that investment in the demo room. That's why you've got Kaleidoscape and a JVC projector. And is it a Crix audio system?
At the moment, I work for a different company now, so
I was waiting for that.
There are changes afoot. So,
yeah, but this is why you have that kind of system. So having Kaleidoscape there and being able to access it, it's a work thing, as much as it's a
pleasure, Phil, isn't it? You know, just as you'll have a reference room, no doubt you might enjoy the occasional movie in there in between reviewing, but if you're working professionally in this, you have to have some sort of test bed for calibration and etc. So it's a very important room for me.
Yeah.
But I watch the occasional film in there.
So again, I mean, the point I was trying to make before we sidetracked, and I just wanted to, for the context, clarify that for listeners and viewers. But obviously, Kaleidoscape, the entry point is £4,000, I believe, for the Strata 5 player. You can spend a lot more than that in terabytes of storage and so on the back of that, and it can be quite an expense. But you're not gonna buy that if all you've got is a 65-inch TV. You know, that kind of product there is for somebody who has made the investment in a home theater system or a large media room, who can take advantage of the picture quality, of the sound quality that's available, and doesn't then mind spending the initial setup costs and then the rental costs on top of that. We then move down the line a little bit, and then you have your specialist players. So, you know, you can buy disc players with hard drives built in, with streaming players built in, that kind of thing. So Zadu, which Steve, you mentioned them a little bit earlier, they're one of the players in the market. There's a couple other players in there who do 8K player physical machines and all that kind of thing. So there's that kind of specialist market in the middle where you can't quite justify the Kaleidoscape, but you can get into ripping your discs and creating NAS drives and trying to create your own little system there. And there's plenty of products in that area of the market as well. We then move down to 4K Blu-ray and Blu-ray and DVD. So physical media format, where it's luckily in the UK, I know the US has seen Best Buy kind of stop selling them and other major retailers. They also lost Fry's. It used to be a tradition, Steve. We used to do it every year. We'd go to Fry's on the day that we flew back from CES. It was a massive store in Vegas. And me and the guys used to go there. And Steve, who was with us, he used to spend a fortune, but he'd be saving up because he would hit Fry's and know exactly which discs he wanted and could grab them. And it was a little bit cheaper than the import route and that kind of thing. But they've gone. You know, a couple of years ago, Fry's disappeared as well. So it is still being supported in the UK. We've got these, you know, nice boutique labels who are making a lot of, and we've seen a lot of good classic catalog titles come out. So we can't really complain. Physical media is still alive, and it's still going to be around for a while. I think, you know, we kind of hinted at, is 4K Blu-ray dead? Not at the minute. No, absolutely not. And I think there's a large enough enthusiast audience out there that will keep that moving. I know that a lot of retailers sell out with the special editions or the steel books that they're doing, and so on. There's still an appetite, a collector's market there for that kind of thing, and people still want quality. And then we move to the streaming side of things. And when we're talking about streaming services, you're talking about the price of one 4K Blu-ray a month for access to a lot of content and a lot of films, depending on which services you decide to subscribe to. But I guess the problem there is not really the quality side of things, because the quality is getting better. And if you're spending, you know, the same amount as a one 4K Blu-ray a month, you're then getting the 4K package, which normally gets you a 4K image. It normally gets you decent audio on the back of that, at least Atmos through a Dolby True HD signal. So you're getting some quality there. You're getting a 4K image for that kind of money. And I think that's good enough. I hate that phrase, but I think that is good enough for the vast majority of people out there, that if they had in the past maybe gone out and bought DVDs and Blu-rays and so on, I think that side of the market is now, and I'm guessing, I don't have no data that this is the case, but I would assume and guess that that area of the market where they may have in the past gone down the disc route, they're now settled on the convenience, Disney Plus, Netflix way of doing things.
The main problem with that is that we spend all evening, my wife and I, arguing about A, what we're going to watch, and you've got to then flip between the different streaming services. What's on Amazon Prime? What's on Netflix? What's on Apple TV? What's on Disney? What's on? You spend the whole evening, and then you forget. Oh, what was that? Which one was that film back on? Was it on Prime? I can't remember. So you've got to go and, you know, it's become, you know, such a time-consuming thing. You know, to at least when we went down to the video stop, that was the film for the evening. No argument. Well, you argued in the video store, didn't you? But you got back, and that's the film. But now, you know, it's just we've got so much content, and a lot of it is dross as well. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I look at IMDb ratings, and if it's below 6.5, I'm not watching it. Which is probably, I should know, my time is precious. You know, and
Well,
I don't want to
I think
watch.
you get You get to a certain age as well, and you look at how long is this? Have I got 2.5 hours to sit and watch this? Or is it a 90 minute? If it's 90 minutes, I'll give you 90 minutes. But any longer than that, not sure.
I'll tell you what, you would have enjoyed the keynote this year, because Barry Sonnenfeld basically said exactly that. It was about time, the amount of he said there's probably about two films that are actually worth the 3 hours spent of his time, and Oppenheimer was one of them. Mm. But also, he said about resolution and about the fact that he has to try to keep, he said the resolution's too high now, and the cameras that you need to buy, that they have to use, be able to record the information, they have to use really nice lenses on the front of it to actually give it a better effect and a more cinematic effect. Mm. So I see the challenges, but then we have to look at how the content is actually created as well. That those guys have a massive challenge, but in my mind, most of the time, with the amount of content that's out there, I just put on notifications of things that I really want to look at, and just speak to friends of what they've seen that's pretty decent. And it's just trying to get up, trying to keep up with it all, isn't it? Because the amount of times I try to get into a series, and then you think it's actually a good series, they do series one, and the next minute it's cancelled. So it's a really hard choice at the moment.
But I think every household's the same. Jules just mentioned there, myself and Michelle are the same. We'll think of things, or we'll see things advertised, like, oh, we'll have to watch that. But then when we actually sit down in front of the TV, and it was, well, what was that thing we wanted to see again? And can you remember which? And you spend half an hour flicking through apps and menus and, oh, what are we going to watch? Oh, I don't know. And you look at the watch and you think, oh, well, it's 8 o'clock now. I don't really want to sit and watch a movie now. You know what I mean?
But I mean, the other thing is, the subscription fees, Phil, you're talking about, one, it's the cost of one disc a month, but that's only if you've got one subscription, one of those streaming services.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you kind of tend to find now you need maybe four or five to get the same range of content as if you probably walked back into your video store, long lost Blockbusters or whatever, because it may not be available on, across all of the streaming.
The thing with Blockbusters or whoever your video rental store was, you walked in, you paid your money, you had to have that back the next day. Mm. So you had to watch it that night. You paid your money, you were going to watch that. You weren't going to lose your £2.50 or whatever it was to rent it for the night. Mm-hmm. If you were lucky, you did a weekend rental, but you still had to watch it because you didn't want to take it back. I think there's so much choice now, and you can dip into whatever you want and so on, that there's that side of it. Oh, well, do I really want to commit to watching this series, or have I got the 2.5 hours to watch this film? Is it any good? And so on. But the other thing is that you may think, well, actually, I've got all the Star Wars stuff on this service or whatever. It can disappear. And if you put it off and then you go back to watch it and you think, I'm pretty sure this film was here last week and it's gone and it's turned up on some other service that you're not subscribed to. The jump backwards and forwards between, it could be on Amazon Prime for a few months and then it'll turn up on Netflix for a few months and then it'll turn up on some other service that you don't subscribe to and so on. So, yeah, I think we had it good back in the days with VHS and Laserdisc.
Yeah, we need a guitar. We need a sort of violin playing in the background, Phil, because... Yeah. It's back very, very, very first world problems, this, isn't it?
It is. But I mean, getting back to the subject, is 4K Blu-ray dead? No, thankfully it's not. Uh-huh. And there's a large market out there, and physical media is going to stay around just for the fact that you own that media. And if you love a certain title or whatever, and you want to collect it, you're going to go and get it on the best possible. If you've got a system that justifies it, there are solutions out there for you. Mm. If you've got really deep pockets, you can get DCI Cinema that Neil was talking about two or three months ago.
Sorry to add to that. I actually got to see some DCI content last week.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, stunning. It was just trailers, but it was the best way to describe it was...
like the cinema?
It's like cinema, but it was so analog and pure and clean. But you know that it's a digital content, and it was so bright and vibrant and detailed. It was beautiful. So, I wish I had some money. That's what I could say.
So, I mean, there's choices out there in terms of your sources. Just make sure, I guess what we're saying, guys, is just make sure that your video chain is set up correctly. Mm-hmm. Just take the time to make sure, go through the menu system, just make sure that everything is set up correctly, especially if you've gone into the trouble of calibrating the display, just make sure that the whole display chain is also calibrated or set up to the best possible quality. And of course, as we've alluded to, a lot of these apps are actually built into displays now, or you can buy yourself an Apple TV box or other box like that, Nvidia, whatever. Get the apps through there. They're slightly higher quality on those devices as well, because you can, the beauty of Apple TV is you can set the you know, the frame rate correctly.
Yep.
And you can set it up correctly that it only flips into HDR when it is yep. HDR and so on.
It's quite a simple thing to fix that, isn't it, Phil? You know, you can
you
just set those to match dynamic frame rate and range yeah. and away you go.
And it's the biggest mistake I think yep. a lot of people make when they first get an Apple TV is they stick it on 4K HDR.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Stick it on a 4K SDR.
Yeah.
Then go further down the menu and select it to content match and to frame match. And mm-hmm. basically what that does then is if it's HDR content, it'll flip in HDR10. If it's Dolby Vision, it'll go into Dolby Vision. And that's the correct way to set up the Apple TV. And of course, you can get things, if you've got Tidal on there, you can get Dolby Atmos music, which is fantastic to sample with as well. If you've got a full-on theater system and you want to sample the delights, that's available on Tidal through Apple TV as well, and you can get that directly into your AVR. So that's us talking about sources. If there is any questions, head over to avforums.com. We've got lots of forums there in terms of covering things like sources, disc players, all that kind of thing, streamers and so on. So if you do have any questions, head over there. The members of our community will help you. That's what they're like. They are there to help like-minded people. And there is no such thing as a silly question. If you don't know, just ask. They're a nice, polite bunch over there. They will help you out. So any questions like that, then head over to AV Forums. Right, we're going to change up the subject. So Steve, you're on a podcast most of this year, talking about a lot of the subjects. And we keep mentioning that Steve is from Cedia. We even got a dance, C-E-D-I-A, to YMCA theme. But who are Cedia? In all seriousness, who are they? Why do they exist? And why should we care, Steve? What is it that you guys do?
Okay, so Cedia have been around since 1989, when you look at it from the global market. So we have members across the world, just over 4,000 members that are integrators and manufacturers and distributors right across the world, as I mentioned. And within the UK, we've been established here since 1996, and from this little office with 11 staff, we look after 47 countries within the EMEA. So essentially, what do? We are a resource centre for the custom installation industry. I will flip between custom installation and smart home. And the reason being is because when we were established, there wasn't anything, smart home wasn't a thing. It was something that's come to light in recent years with a lot more consumer electronics brands coming into the industry. But essentially, we are the resource centre, that engagement point between consumers, trade suppliers, manufacturers, distributors, and more importantly, the integrators that integrate the technology for their clients and give those services to those consumers right across the board. And what we've seen in recent years with the growth of the market, with the advent of companies like Google, Apple, whomever, getting into the mix as well, it's become even more wide. So that could incorporate things like EV, electric vehicles, sorry, before I start getting into jargons, or renewables or sustainability. So it's not just about AV. Our members can integrate just technology to ensure that the client is getting the best performance for their project, whether that be cost saving, security, lighting, shading, right across the board. And we, as a one of the main reasons why people or integrators get involved with us is education. So we have a resource center where people can come in, have face-to-face education, have online education. We hold seminars. If I tell you, last week at Expo, we had 68 sessions of education, 5 workshops that were specific around THX, which is in around cinema design, rack building, RP22, which is one of our white papers, and incorporating that workshop, or certification. So we have within the education certifications in things like cable infrastructure, integrated systems technician, networking. This is quite a diverse range of subjects, business related as well. So as I say, for the integrators to become fully forewarned, forearmed to be able to complete and projects for clients.
So
as a summary,
there's quite a bit of things to kind of deep dive in here and maybe find out a little bit more about. So the education side, I think this is the important thing, certainly from my point of view, and I guess from AV Forums, are always about good information, good education, telling the consumer what they should be looking for and so on. So if they are looking at maybe hiring somebody to put a system in, and that doesn't have to be an AV system, it could be an all-house audio system, it could be security systems, all that kind of thing. These are all the whole vast number of things that you guys look at and cover in terms of education. It's that person, if they are CDIA certified, what does that say to the consumer who's thinking about hiring versus another company who are not CDIA certified? Is there a big difference between those companies?
So there is. So we have various levels within membership. So as it stands, anybody can come along and sign up as a CDIA member, and then they will engage in some extra training. And then within the Finder service that we have on the website on CDIA.net, they will then be able to, the client can, potential client, put in a postcode, and then they can see who's local to them. And then that, on that particular listing, they would see what are those attributes that those particular integrators have within that region. Mm-hmm. And, if there are certifications, that is a bonus to that particular integration company. It's normally based around an individual within that company, but you can understand that they've spent the time to go through some of the education with CDIA. But I always would hope that, even if they're just a member without actually being certified, that they would look at being a very competent member because they are a CDIA member.
I know this is... I have to ask the question because I know my members would and our audience would be, why didn't you ask the question? So it's a little bit of a difficult one for you, Steve. But basically, this is the industry policing the industry, basically, in terms of it's the industry that make up the CDIA board. They are integrators themselves who are voted onto the board.
Yeah.
So I guess the question that the more cynical person out there would ask is, well, it's just the industry serving the industry and saying that they can do certain things because they all vote for each other, and it's a bit of a boys' club, to use a phrase.
I would say if you were talking about the main global board, then yes, it's like with any, you say the same if it was GasSafe or NIC, EIC, if I'm talking about it from the UK perspective, because it depends how many people outside of the industry do you want actually steering the trade association, because would you want somebody that doesn't have any experience around what their members need or their members require? Because bearing in mind, they would be voted on by the members, their integrated members, and they would have some requirements or needs or wants that their association should support them with. But at the same time, the way that it's split is that the board is operations, and then we are, the board is strategy and we are operations. So at the end of the day, it's more about if they want to have a better understanding of what we're going to be doing moving forward and how we should be shaping, how the future should be shaped, and how we should be getting ready to be engaged in a certain program, maybe that be workforce development, new education opportunities, or looking for new ways that we can engage with consumers, then that would be driven by the board. But in terms of how that's done, that would be driven by the staff within CDIA. So that's how it works and has worked for the last years easily. And then I always look at the membership is such a diverse group of people across the world. Well, even if I look at the UK guys, because that's the guys I normally engage with, from smaller companies to larger companies, from Land's End to John O'Groats. We've got everybody involved now. And with certain events that we host for members, well, for the industry, as we have the tech summit. So as long as you're within the industry as a trade event that we host in various places around the country, so four different venues around the country, so people can get involved, get engaged, give their feedback. And if you don't have a voice or feel that you don't have a voice, then pick up a phone, send an email, call me, reach out to me, and we listen, to be honest. We try to do the best that we can, but most of the time it's we work with what we've got and try to ensure that we've got things like, in terms of legislation, we're trying to work with, trying to promote our industry most of all. And then hopefully in the future, we'll be having a more consumer aware, more of a consumer awareness campaign coming through.
Yeah. Jules, you're a CDA member, have been for a long time. You get involved with CDA. Uh-huh. So maybe from your aspect, maybe you can give us a little bit of what you see CDA as and how CDA works for you.
It provides educational opportunities. If you're a CDA member, you get reduced price on various training events, which is very useful. There's definitely a need always for education. Things never stay the same. So certainly from the video side of things, that's always the case, isn't it, Phil? Things are constantly changing. We have to update our PVA training program all the time. So there is definitely a need for CDA in terms of educating and continuing education. So that's been of use and interest. The other thing is networking as well. If you're within CDA, you're part of a fellowship. A fellowship of the ring, but
let's not talk about that.
I don't know which character you'd be.
Is that the ring doorbell? Is it
the ring doorbell? Yeah, but yeah. I mean, there is that to it as well. It provides excellent networking opportunities. So, if you and opportunities for collaboration between CDA members, you know, if you say to, so for me, becoming CDA certified was important to establish in the minds of other CDA members that I was committed to the craft, committed to the profession, as opposed to somebody who couldn't be bothered or didn't want to spend the money on it or whatever. There's no guarantee that if you're a CDA member that you're always going to be doing good work. Everybody obviously has off days, but it does say something about your commitment to expertise and professionalism, and you're visible to other CDA members. So I think that the sort of almost accountability side is quite important as well. Mm. And I just get to spend a lot more time with Steve Carter as well. So that's the other benefit.
Yeah. I guess the encouraging thing here is that it's a trade body, and that you do look after your members and that you're always pushing. And this is where I really appreciate what CDA do, is that you're always pushing good information. You're always pushing good education. And you also have your finger on the pulse of new technologies that come through. So my knowledge of CDA and you know, over the last 20 odd years that I've been involved with this, it's changed massively. Like you say, going back to when integration was a really specialist craft that, you know, you were talking about the CDA systems that were going in that would cost a lot of money, and you needed to have that education behind you and so on. And as the technology has gotten better and it's become more and more accessible for more and more people, that industry has exploded. And I think on the back of that explosion, you still have to have good education, you still have to have good practice, you have to have good legislation in place in terms of like RP 2022 that you're talking about. You know, this is guidance that if everybody follows, you're all going to end up with a set of results that's going to keep the client happy, or is going to produce a system of some kind, whatever it is that's being installed, is to a certain level, Steve.
And the thing for me is, and this is my personal opinion, just in case anybody's listening to this and everybody's like, you shouldn't say this, Steve. the thing for me is, I feel that our industry is an inevitability in the sense of, if you look at most people, they will have, I know we joked just previously about Ring, but if you'd have said 15 years ago, you'd have a security camera on your front door, would you have said you'd have that?
You'd want it, but you would think it was mega expensive and all the wiring that you would need.
So all of us have now, most of us have some type of Ring or Google or some type of doorbell on our door. What I'm trying to say is when you're looking at wireless technology for things in and around streaming audio, we've been talking about streaming video, and let's be frank, most people will use that option. But if you want to have a robust system, it would have a hardwired solution with an access point. Who's going to install that for you? Because you're going to have different companies or different abilities within our community. Even if you look at the AV Forums members, a lot of them are going to be enthusiasts that will do that. But, you know, where would they be able to access information to do it correctly and ensure that no one can get into your network and then be able to do anything underhand with your system? Our members do that. But then the other key point of this and what I'm trying to say is how many engineers are out there? And I can tell you this now, it's one of those careers where when I'm talking to various companies across the country, they are desperate for engineers to come in, for the youth to come in, to be able to go out, put those cables in those walls, to be able to set up those systems, whether it be networking, lighting, outdoor entertainment spaces, security, whatever that may be. And over the past few years, CEDIA has been very committed to outreach to schools and colleges to build up their knowledge so they understand that there are these resources available to them. And there is an industry that they can plug into, pardon the pun. And then off the back of that, then they can plug into an apprenticeship program, or they can, which has now been ratified. So, you know, it's not just the case of it's a bunch of techie guys, a bunch of nerds that are putting out really high-end products and projects. It's right across the board now. And we try to promote it as much as possible to the design and build community, to schools and colleges, and hopefully the next phase will be to consumers so they know who to engage with. Because as you say, the point of where the accessibility and where people can engage with the industry is now coming lower. So whereas before it was seen as a high net worth individual's dream, or not even dream, but standard, it's now coming down into our costings and our price bracket, so we can then think, you know, actually I want to have some nice lighting, and also I need some security cameras because I'm going to be away next week. Or if I own an Airbnb, I want to be able to remote monitor what I'm doing with my property. So it's little things like that, but it's making sure that people within our industry know that there's some way of educating their staff, because they might have a bigger company and they don't want to go through the whole education themselves. So they send them over to us, and we can work with them on those programs.
Yeah. And it's now a huge industry, smart home and smart things. And, you know, it's something that either, you know, a consumer can do it themselves using an app and a couple of devices, but then the bug, you know, sets in, and it's like, well, I could do this, and how do I do that, and so on, and that's a new industry that didn't exist, like you say, and like I said, back in the day, it was a high net worth individual who was hiring the services of a CEDIA member, because it took a lot back then to do and to achieve what we're now talking about, that's available to a mass market. The products are everywhere at the minute. You just have to go on Amazon and run a search, and you can see how many different products there are that can do like fancy lighting or you know, voice activated, whatever now, with Alexa and others. Sorry, I just said that. Alexa, switch off the lights. You should never say that on a podcast.
No.
But that kind of thing. You know, we now have a huge market there, Steve, where
if you consider just last year, the market's worth 2.9 billion in the UK alone. Mm.
Yeah,
so
it's huge.
It's something that we're committed to ensuring that our members can engage with the consumers, and more importantly, the consumers know who to engage with. at some point.
So it's that peace of mind. It's the, if you're going and you're looking for somebody to help integrate a system in, yet because it is that little bit too complicated for the enthusiast or the DIYer or so on, or you just want a really good job doing, you want the cables hidden properly and so on, and you want it to look like a really nice minimalist installation and so on. There's companies out there, and all you need to do is make sure that they are educated and part of a trade body, and the trade body is CEDIA. So that's what they're there for. And if they're CEDIA members, they will have had the right input, the right education. They'll have trained their members and their staff and so on to be to a certain level within their marketplace. So thanks for explaining CEDIA to us. We will deep dive in future podcasts. We'll cover different areas. We keep mentioning RP22, and we haven't discussed any of the details of that just yet. So we will get into that in a podcast in the future. And if you're interested in that, just look out for that podcast, which will be coming up soon. So before we finish for this week's edition, I did mention a little while ago that I'm not building a home cinema. I'm building a workspace, but that workspace, obviously, with what I do for a living, is going to require quite a few unique approaches, let's say. So the space itself is tiny. So for the last 20 years, I used a large bedroom in a two-bedroom flat. I used the largest bedroom as my dedicated home theater, and then it turned into a workspace because of what I then started doing for a living and so on. So I had all this space. I was able to produce different bits and pieces of reviews and so on, but it never actually worked. It never flowed until I actually moved out of there, and it was up for sale, and for the time that it was up for sale, I actually turned it into a workspace that did work and so on, knowing that I was moving to a new space with 16 feet by 8 feet, so not a lot. Sorry to use old figures there. I'm feet and inches person, me, I'm not meters. I think it's 4.7 meters by 2.5 meters. I think I've maybe got that right. So that's a space. It's not huge. What it needs to do is it needs to be a room that I can test audio equipment in. I need to be able to review and test TVs. I need complete light control. I also need it to look like a normal living room with light, natural light coming in, so I can test TVs properly and so on and do all the measurements. I need to have all my measurement gear in there and available in some way to me. I need at least two TV racks or TV stands to compare TVs together up to 65 inches. What else I need in there? Oh, yeah, I need some kind of flooring that's going to be acoustically kind. I need wall coverings that are, again, going to help with the acoustics of the space. There needs to be at least a 5.1 system in there, but the requirement to have at least a 5.1.2 or 4 system in there. For testing audio gear, there needs to be an audio rack in there. There's a boiler that needs to be covered up in some way, because obviously it's a new build and boilers get put into a single garage. Well, did I mention it was a single garage, this room? The room actually has to be built, first of all. So it is an integrated garage with a garage door. So we need to build a wall. I need to do all the permissions that need to be done. So does it need planning permission? We need to find that out. Definitely you're going to need some building control being involved. Mm. And you need to find a builder who's going to build that to regs. Needs to be then visited a number of times by building control. I didn't know any of this until I started digging into it and trying to find it. So it's quite the challenge. And this little space also, on top of everything I've just mentioned, has to be a YouTube studio. Because I have to shoot video in there as well. So I also have to have nice backgrounds that can be used in piece-to-camera shots and so on. I am experimenting with various different solutions for the space. So if I just turn off the blur on the background, this contraption here is what I'm working on at the moment. So that is a light stand. It's also got a camera on it there. There's an auto cue in front of the camera. There's a little monitor that I can see what the camera sees, and then obviously the video light as well. And that's on wheels, so that can be wheeled around. So I don't have a tripod. I don't have two or three light stands with lights, and so taking up 10 feet of my 16-foot floor space. So it's quite the challenge, and it's going to get started very, very soon. So stay tuned. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to document it for all you guys. Because you're maybe not building a YouTube studio, you're maybe not testing TVs or anything like that. But I bet you, some of you out there have got a single garage that's full of cardboard boxes and other things that you think, actually, that could make a really nice living space, or it could make a really nice playroom for the kids, or I could use it for a home cinema, or I could use it as a media room, or so on. And my process is going to be exactly the same as your process, other than you're probably not going to need is to cram as much in as I do, and everything's going to be on wheels, basically. That's it's going to have an LVT floor because everything needs to be on wheels to wheel everything in and out and so on. But anyway, we're going to get that started very, very soon, and I'm going to get the help of the guys here. Neil's been helping out with some of the design aspects and taking on board some of that and giving me some feedback and ideas on what we could potentially do with the space. I've spoken to Jules about possible solutions in terms of what we could do with the audio and how to hide cables and that kind of thing, him working for Habitech and some of the brands that they deal with. And of course, I'll have to speak to Steve at some point about training and making sure that I'm doing everything to how Cedar would like it done in terms of the process and so on. So it's going to be fun. I'm going to try and make it fun. We're going to document everything. There's going to be a thread on EV Forums. It exists at the minute. It hasn't been updated because things haven't quite gotten started yet. So go find a thread and bookmark the thread on EV Forums. It's in the Home Cinema Construction Forums. We're also going to do some video. I'm going to time lapse everything. We're going to follow the process in terms of actually building the room. It's not just removing a garage door and putting a wall in. There's all sorts that has to be done, insulation, all that kind of thing. So if you're interested in that, there's going to be videos covering all that kind of thing. And then we get onto the exciting stuff of how do we cram a reference audio system, six TVs, all the calibration gear, measuring equipment, all that kind of thing, in a little space, and it'd be a YouTube studio. It's a challenge. So hopefully you'll join us for that when we get started building that and the process that we go through for that. And then hopefully at the end of it, we'll have something that's half decent and interesting. We'll see. We'll see how that turns out. I was just about to sign off there and just realized that we haven't done the competitions, Jules. Tell us all about this fantastic projector that people can win.
Sure, Phil. Yes, you can win an LG Cinebeam Q projector worth £1,000, a compact and portable 4K projector with wireless connectivity for streaming, movie watching, and gaming wherever you want. Closing date is 11:59 p.m., Tuesday, 15th of October, 2024.
Yeah, cracking little prize there. Go enter. If it, even if it's just taking the projector out in the garden for the kids, put a sheet up against the wall on a nice sunny evening and watch Monsters, Inc. or whatever in the garden. It's a cracking little projector that, and it's of course 4K resolution as well. All competitions are open to AV Forums members aged 18 and over, and you must be a resident of the UK. So head over avforums.com/competitions. There's also DVDs, Blu-rays, 4K discs available for patrons and standard AVF members for you to win there. Well, also got disc competitions. They are open to, like I say, members and patrons, and we've got some previous winners. So Jules, why don't you do
I
the
have it.
honors there?
Yep, absolutely. We've got Stevio67 who won the Denon AVR X1800H AVR worth 699, courtesy of Peter Tyson. We
Cracking
have
prize.
BHXTC who won a pair of QAQ6 M40 powered micro tower speakers and QED digital cables worth £1,069. And then we
Excellent.
have Badger Stuter, who won a copy of Chinatown on 50th Anniversary Collector's Edition 4K Ultra HD worth £40.
And of course, you can become a patron and support us that way. And we do have some new patrons as well. So, who's joined us recently?
We've got Richard Saunders, I think it's IWF or LWF, J.A. Kamal, Sauerkraut, Cloud Atlas, Ewan Innes, Taryn, and Les Hewitt.
Thank you very much for your support, guys. Really, I do appreciate that. One day, with your help, we might produce a decent podcast. Fingers crossed that that day comes. And of course, bought us a coffee, tea, and Paul Haggard. Thank you very much for buying us three coffees each. Thank you. That's amazing. That's it for the Home AV podcast for this week. My thanks to Jules and Steve. Thanks very much, guys.
Cheers, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
And of course, our next episode will be the movies and TV show edition with Kaz and the movies team. That's Monday, the 23rd of September. And that'll be followed by the physical media show, which is 4K and the Blu-ray disc show. Go support physical media. I know you guys love that stuff and you are listening to that podcast. So thank you very much. Go support the guys. That's Thursday, the 26th of September that episode will be released. All the episodes are from 7 p.m. on the AV Forums podcast YouTube channel. We also do audio only through Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all the major podcast providers. You should be able to find the AV Forums podcast on there. If you really like what we do, if you like the content, if you think people out there, like-minded people to yourself, would find it useful, then why not share the content on your social channels or on forums and so on? Get more people involved in the community. We all benefit from that. Of course, do the usual cliched social media stuff like liking and subscribing and all the rest of it. And if you want to buy us a coffee, you can buy me a coffee. coffee.com/AV Forums. And thank you to everybody that has supported us up to now. That's it for this week. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening. And we'll catch you again soon. Goodbye.